Okay. So last time, so today we are going to start really the discussion on distributed systems. So last time we had a quick overview of networking, like a 453 condensed one lecture. Okay, so all the stuff you need to know to sort of understand the discussion on file systems, and today we are actually going to look at remote procedure calls. Okay. So the basic concept we looked at is what is a network, what does it enable, how messages are sent from the source to the destination, the fact that there is something called a protocol stack that is used by both endpoints to send messages back and forth. TCP/IP is the more popular one. Okay. So for the rest of the discussion, we are going to assume that we understand what a network is, how it works, how messages are sent, and more specifically we'll assume that the network provides a reliable end-to-end message channel abstraction. Okay, so we'll assume whatever packets are sent from machine A to machine B always reach machine B. Okay, so if the packets get lost in transit, the transport protocol will retransmit, do whatever it takes. So we'll not worry about any of the network idiosyncrasies. So what we'll do is, given that background, we will start this talking about distributed systems. So essentially, last time I mentioned why we should consider distributed systems at all. What are their benefits? We said you have n machines that are all connected over the network that are participating in a distributed system. Okay, so you get the benefit of computational resources, resource sharing, and so on. Okay, but some things also get hard. Okay, so here are all the problems that you really need to look at. Okay, how to enable resource sharing? How do you actually access resources on a different machine? Whether it's computational resources, files stored on a different machine, whatever that resource is, how is that done? Okay. There's a big issue of timing. Okay, so this we will not have time to go into this in this class, but what one thing that actually gets hard in a distributed system or a distributed application is synchronization. Okay, the big problem really is that if you use time, which is wall clock time, the time on a machine to do anything that requires synchronization, then there are bigger problems because clocks may not be synchronized across machines. Okay. On a single machine, okay, it is always possible to reason about the order in which some events have happened. Okay, because there is one clock, you can timestamp each of the events and say, did this write happen before something else, or did you actually update the variable? If you have multiple threads, did thread A update the variable before thread B read it? You can always reason about this. Okay? When you have a distributed system, there is no single clock that is global, okay, that tells you the exact time. Okay, every clock is local to a machine. So you can't compare the time on machine A with time on machine B. Okay, because if the clocks are not synchronized, the comparing them is meaningless. You cannot reason about which event happened before which other event. Okay, this is a major issue in any distributed application. If you have to do anything that requires synchronization, using timestamps is always a problem. Okay, now there's a whole set of slew of techniques that have been designed to work in a distributed environment even when clocks are not synchronized. You can ignore the need to synchronize clocks and you can still do interesting things. Because we are in this class, we will not actually look at that. That is actually a set of topics we cover in a graduate course on distributed system. But just keep in mind that this is a problem. Okay? A simple way to solve this problem is to run a time synchronization protocol which somewhat synchronizes the clock. Okay, so if you heard of things like NTP, it's called Network Time Protocol. Yeah, so NTP, if you run NTP on the machine, it actually contacts a time server somewhere. Time server is another machine that somehow knows the time. Yeah, and you basically synchronize your clock and that of the time server. So then basically both clocks are in sync, subject to some error tolerance. Okay, some few maybe off by a few milliseconds, but they are generally in sync. Okay, so for any application that can tolerate that kind of error, you are okay. If you want more precise synchronization, that doesn't work. Okay, so timing is a big problem. Okay, critical section is another problem. Okay, everything we studied, locks, mutexes, semaphores, monitors, just don't work in a distributed environment. Okay, because you have multiple processes. Processes are running on different machines. a lock that is taken by a process on machine A means nothing to machine B, because that is basically different address spaces, different machines. So now the need to synchronization hasn't gone away, but all of the techniques we studied just don't work anymore. So there's an entire area called distributed synchronization, which looks at how do you have implement the notion of a distributed lock. This is a lock that multiple processes on different machines can acquire and release. So a big area of work. Again, we are not going to really look at that. Same is true of deadlock detection and recovery. So how do you detect a deadlock between 10 processes on 10 different machines? So in the centralized case, we ran a cycle detector and everything was fine. We looked not fine, but we could detect a deadlock if we could find a cycle and then break the cycle. Now if you have 10 machines or 30 machines that are all on a network, how do you run this algorithm? It doesn't have to run on one machine, it has to figure out what has happened on each of these machines. Becomes a lot more complex. There's a chapter in the book on distributed deadlock detection. We will actually not get to that. We will stop at distributed file system, but there are distributed techniques to do that. Failure recovery is another problem, something we haven't actually looked at all in this course, but becomes a very important issue in a distributed application. So in a distributed system, you have multiple components, they run on multiple machines. The probability of a failure in a system that has n components is n times the probability, or not n times, but is much higher than the probability of a failure on a single machine. So you have to build your application under the assumption that some components might fail. If you have what are called single points of failure, your entire application goes down if one machine goes down. This often happens when you see Twitter is down or your mail has gone down, because it relies on some component that has gone down. And that sort of brings down whatever you are trying to do. If you build a good distributed system, they should be able to function even when some components have failed. It's an important design principle. But all of those things make the design of distributed applications much harder than centralized applications. You get all these benefits, but there are complications as well. So today we'll look at how to address a few, but not necessarily all of those. That's really a topic for an entire course. Take the first one, which is resource sharing, and see how you can go about sharing resources. So there are, from a sort of a very generic abstract standpoint, there are three ways to share resources. So one is you basically call data migration, one is called compute migration, the last one is called job migration. So in data migration, the data actually moves to where the computation is. So we'll assume that the data for this application resides on some machine, the computation, which is the code, is running on some other machine. In data migration, the data moves to the code. In code migration, the code goes to the data. So two different ways of designing your application. Now think of applications that you actually use in sort of day for day-to-day computing needs, and think about which ones are using data migration and which ones are using compute migration. So let's take example of a search engine. Let's say Google. You do a Google search. So would you sort of classify that as a data migration technique or a compute migration technique? Or does it even map to either of these two? Does it even make sense to think of? Yes.
I think it would be computation migration, because you're sending like a simple query over to Google and then they're blasting through a huge index of stuff and then just returning like simple results to you.
Okay. So the suggestion here is that making a search query on Google is an example of compute migration. Okay, so first you have to ask what is the computation that's even migrating. Okay, so when you type a few words and hit search, what your browser has done is actually it's constructed a query. A query is a simple program, it's a simple piece of computation which essentially says, send me all the results that match these keywords that you have indexed somewhere. What is the data? The data is the index that Google has constructed by crawling web pages on the internet. So the data is the index, the computation in this case is the query. So when you hit search, your browser is actually sending the query to the server. Okay? So your computation has gone to where the data is. It's operating on the data and returning you the results. Okay, example of a computation migration. Yes, question.
So the fact that the data is outsourced does not make it data and computation migration. Just refers to the act of transfer.
Yes. So migration just involves the act of transferring this from one machine to another. Okay, so in this case, the query is moved. What are examples of data migration?
BitTorrent.
That's file download application. There's no computation there.
Yeah.
You're just downloading some data. Okay, so you have to think of, yeah. Pulling or adding to a database. Okay, so if you are trying to insert some records, okay, so filling out a web form is an example of essentially what you just said. So you have a form in a browser, you fill some data entries and you hit submit. Okay, that's some data that you are essentially submitted to the system. The data moves to the server, where there is some computation. First, the server is going to do some error checks on whatever form you submitted. It may process that. It may send you back results. Okay, that's an example of, and then it may update some database. Okay, so which is basically an example of data migration. Okay, so then there are things like job migration. So there is examples which may or may not actually make sense, but in the context of cloud computing or virtualization, terms that you may have heard of, didn't actually cover that completely here. You have resources that you can actually start on the fly. So yes, cloud computing essentially allows you to start up machines somewhere on the internet in some server room somewhere. Server rooms are called data centers, and you can run whatever computation you want. Okay. The nice thing about that is you can actually move your data and your program from one machine to another. Okay, so why is that useful? So assume that you start up a simple website, or maybe you have a blog. Okay, so you basically put up your blog, which consists of the data in your blog, which is the content, and any processing that the server needs to do. Initially, maybe nobody reads your blog. Okay, so it's sort of, there's nothing much happening, but maybe someday you make a blog post that is of interest to someone and everybody tweets it, or something happens that makes it very popular. Okay, now the load on the server goes up because everybody is reading your blog post. Okay? At some point the server may get overloaded, may actually start crash because it cannot handle the load. Okay, if you have heard of slash dotting, this is what happens. So some article gets posted on /dot, everybody clicks on the link all at the same time trying to go to some site just goes down. Okay? But in job migration, what can happen is if you are running on in a cloud computing environment, you can take your entire application and the data and just move it to a bigger machine. Okay, you can say, I was running on this small single CPU machine, I want a 4-core machine because the load has gone up and I want 8 GB of RAM. You can take the whole thing and move it over. And there are mechanisms like virtualization that allow you to do that. Okay, let's not worry about how that is done, but just the fact that it can be done. Okay, so the entire job, which computes all the computation and the data, moves from one machine to another. Okay, so you have to get advanced features like this with the job migration. Now the interesting thing is, if you are designing your application, okay, you have to decide what is the model you are using. In some cases, some models fetch naturally, right? Some other cases, you have both options. You could do data migration, you could do job migration, or rather compute migration. Like in Google, it doesn't make sense when you type the search query for the Google to send you the index and say you can now look at it locally and figure out the results. That doesn't make any sense. Okay? But there are applications where it may make more sense for you to download your data and do local computation. So the data comes to you and you compute locally, or you send off your request to some other machine where the data resides and you process it there. Both of those actually might be feasible options, and then you have to decide which one you want to do. Okay, so there are file systems, there are many kinds of applications that use one or the other, and in some cases both, right, depending on the scenario. But when you design an application, you have to decide what is it that you are going to do, how are you going to share the resources, okay, in terms of data and compute and so on. Okay. So the second dimension that decides how resource sharing is done is basically the relationship between computation and communication. Okay, that also in many cases decides whether you will do data migration or compute migration. Okay, so if network bandwidth is cheap and computation is scarce, okay, then you basically try to use that network bandwidth in some useful way to the application. Okay, if network bandwidth is scarce, okay, you may actually start using some other computational techniques to do useful. Okay, case in point is maybe today's smartphones. Okay, phones basically have, let's say, 3G or 2G data connection. Okay, data connections cost money. Okay, so I would say that in these cases, either network bandwidth is scarce or is precious. Okay, so you don't want to download a very large movie. Okay, maybe it's a 6 gigabyte DVD over your phone connection, because A, it is very slow. B, you basically use up your entire bucket of whatever data plan you have and you get charged more. Okay? So you basically would just never do that. But if you want to watch something, then you might actually do things remotely, compress it and send things to you, because communication is expensive, okay, or scarce. Okay. On the other hand, if you are on a LAN with maybe a gigabit Ethernet connectivity, it is perfectly feasible for you to fetch a lot of data and do things locally, or even cache that data. Okay. And there are applications that will actually keep large caches and just keep downloading and fetching things and keeping it locally. Okay. So how you design that application has to keep in mind what kind of environment that application will run in. Okay. Is it going to run in environments where communication is relatively scarce and computation or CPU cycles are inexpensive or available, lots of them are available, or vice versa, is one scarce. So depending on that, you may actually need to decide how you will decide how your application should work. Okay? Whenever communication is scarce, you will do compression, you will try to send as little data as possible, you will do local things, not try to do any communication, etc. When it's not, you will just use as much bandwidth as you want. You will download large amounts of content, and that's fine. That's what that environment allows you to do. So, any questions on this? Okay. So, now let's come back to the discussion on data migration and compute migration. We'll make that a little more explicit. Okay, so this happens often in a sort of file systems or any application that's doing data access. So we assume that there are two machines, A and B, and A is trying to access a file from B. Okay, so you have two options. So one is copy the file from B to A. Okay? The other one is basically keep the file at B and remotely access it at A. Okay, so here's the scenario. And these two options incidentally actually dictate the distributed file systems that you see in practice. Okay, they'll apply one of these two approaches. So let's say server client. Okay, popular form of distributed systems are what are called client server system. Okay, some machines are called servers, they provide useful services. Other machines are called clients, they access services on these machines. A very popular way of building any distributed application. So here, server stores file, server is A, this is B. Okay, here is an app that wants to access that file. Okay, in the first model, okay, which says you let's get the file to this machine. Okay, so there's a copy of the, so there's a copy here that you make a local copy here, and then from that point on, all accesses to the file are local. Okay, you pay a one-time cost of bringing the file over the network, but all subsequent accesses are local to that machine. Okay, so and they are fast as a result as well. Okay, that is basically called it's called the upload-download model. Okay, why you have to upload, I'll talk about in just a minute. Okay, but as you can see, there's at least you're downloading the file. Okay. Another possible approach for this application to access the file is to actually send explicit requests for portions of the file to the server, and the server only retrieves that part of the file and send it back. Okay, so if you say read the next 10 bytes, you send that request to the server takes this file, retrieves 10 bytes and just sends that. Okay, so every time you need to access any part of the file, you send an explicit request, you only get that portion and you bring it over. Okay, in the first case, the first time you access the file, the whole file comes over. So the in that case, when you say read 10 bytes, you'll read it from the local copy. No more communication is needed with the server. Okay, so these are basically the two models that you can use to decide if an application wants to access a remote file, how would you allow those accesses. Okay. Now going back to whether communication is cheap or not, you can actually sort of analyze this and understand what the trade-offs are. Okay. So in the first case, you will pay a one-time cost, okay, to bringing the file, and then all of the subsequent accesses are local. Okay, and you might do that if the file size is reasonable. If you are accessing a 1 gigabyte file, okay, trying to fetch the whole file over the network so that all accesses are local may not make sense unless you are going to access a lot of content on that file. Because the file is large, the upfront cost you pay to fetch it is actually quite high. Okay, so you may be better off doing the latter model where you only selectively retrieve portions of the file and bring it. But if the file size is reasonable, it makes a lot of sense to bring it over the network. Okay, so at some point you have to decide whether is the network bandwidth good enough for me to do this, or should I just do this. Okay, this is going to be cheaper because you just pay cost every time you read or write. You don't pay that upfront cost of bringing the whole file over. Okay, is that clear? So next time when we talk about distributed file system, we'll come back to this. Okay, there are file systems that use this model and there are file systems that use... Yes, your question.
So in this case, it says, you know, data migration may occur when the process is say access the file at site B.
Yes.
How is that different from me at site A asking Google to look at their database at site B?
Okay, repeat the last part of your question. How is that different from you asking Google to do what?
To look at their database, which is held at their site.
Yes.
So isn't that an example of data migration? Because you're a process, and you're accessing a file remotely.
You're accessing a file remotely.
File being the database. Because you only want a piece of it. You only want the part of that.
It is not data migration. In data migration, that whole data has to come to you, not parts of the data. When you're sending a search query, you're retrieving only a part of the index and fetching that back, not the whole thing.
So in
that is selective, think of it as more selective retrieval. It's sort of this model. Because the index is large, your query only requires you to access a part of the index, and that's the only thing you're fetching.
Right, so you're saying it's different, or you're saying it's the same?
Google's model is this.
Okay, that's...
Right? So you could have done that. It doesn't make sense. That this would say, if you want to type a search query, go to Google, download the whole index, run the query locally.
So 2 is not data migration then?
2 is... No, so... Think... So first of all, what the Google search query thing is actually more an example of a compute migration because a piece of code has gone over, okay, to where the computation is. So you shouldn't try to compare those two. But if you look at how data is getting accessed, it is this model, not that. Okay? These are two different ways of doing it. Yes, question.
I'm just thinking, like, if you have like a 100 terabyte like database thing you need to work through, and you're accessing it like 50 gigabytes at a time, it's not feasible to really transfer the whole thing over from one machine to the other, but it's also not really feasible to access 50 gigabytes at a time over the network. Is there like a specific... like one you would choose, like wouldn't there be like more latency and stuff on the network, like
right? So
it would be better to maybe transfer the whole thing, like.
So that's a very good question, right? So this is exactly the kind of question you will have to answer when you design your application. Okay, so you are saying, assume that the data set is 1 terabyte inside. Assume that each request retrieves 50 gigabyte. Okay, now 1 terabyte is big, 50 gigabyte is also big. What model would you use? Would you use this one of these models or neither? Okay, maybe what you are doing, you want to use compute migration where you go send the entire code over and run it locally where the machine is and just send you the results. Okay, there is, so maybe your query needs to access 50 gigabytes of data, but it computes some result over that 50 gigabytes and just gives you maybe a much shorter answer. Okay, so in that case, you're better off just sending the query over, retrieving that 50 gigabyte locally at the server, doing the computation, whole processing there, and then sending the result. Okay, so that may be much better. You could fetch 50 gigabytes, but then if the end result is you have one answer saying this is yes, no, or this is what it is. It's better not even doing that. Better off not doing that. Okay. So what about compute migration? So compute migration, as I was saying, occurs when you send a small piece of code to where the data is, you compute the results and you send it back. There are many examples of this. Google search query is just one example. Any database query that you send to a database server is another example. Anytime you fill a form and hit submit, there's some processing happening, so you're sending some stuff over and so on. Okay, so there are many such examples. What we will do today is actually look at one specific way to build applications that do compute migration. This is called remote procedure calls, or RPCs. Okay? In the Java world, they are called RMIs, remote method invocation. Fairly equivalent concepts, but I'll explain what the concept is, and then basically we'll see how that works. So, okay, actually we have to wait for it because there are a couple of slides. So what happens in a remote procedure call? Let's just draw a figure here and then we'll go to the details in a couple of slides. Okay, so a nice way of writing distributed application. So I'll give you the intuition behind what remote procedure calls are. Okay. So remote procedure calls are a way of writing a distributed application without realizing you're writing a distributed application. Okay, so how does that work? So it basically, you write your code and you basically break your code into pieces, each of which is in a method or a function. Okay, just as you would do with a normal program, a centralized program. Okay, but the interesting thing you do is you figure out which pieces of this code run on which machine. Okay, so and that is what makes the application distributed. So in this case, you have main function, main calls foo. So if you had a centralized application, the code for foo would be actually in the same address space. You would just go there, do the call, whatever, the execute this function and return. In a remote procedure call, the code for foo actually resides on another machine. Okay, so remote procedure call is a way for you to invoke a function where that function actually is residing on some other machine. So you are when you do this, your program internally when it runs is actually going to invoke that code which is running in a completely different process on a different machine. Okay, and then you can pass arguments. It will do whatever it's doing. It'll return these values. Okay, some value will show it, and then this value essentially returns here. And you write this code as if it was a centralized piece of code. The fact that to execute foo, you have to actually go to some other machine and retrieve and get back the results of whatever foo is not something you worry about as a programmer. All of that and piece of magic that has to happen to send this request over, execute it, get the results back, that's automatically written for you. So that code is generated for you on the fly by the compiler, and the compiler basically takes care of those details. So you don't worry about messy details of which machine. Okay, you are just calling foo. You haven't even specified what machine it is running on. Okay, you don't actually say how should you contact that machine. All that is done for you. Okay, so it basically is your programming distributed application at a much higher level of abstraction. Okay, if you have done a networking course, you will realize that this is actually a very different way of writing a distributed application over something like socket communication. Okay, if I don't know how many of you know what socket communication is. Socket communication, you have to explicitly set up a connection to another machine, send a message, have that other machine receive that message, do the processing, return everything to you, the results to you, etc. Okay, all of that is not required. Okay, you just write code. So here you write the code for foo, you run it in a process. Here you write the code for main, you run it in a process. Okay, you have to run it for a special compiler called an RPC compiler. So the RPC compiler takes care of all of the stuff that needs to happen to execute foo, how to track it down and so on and so on. Okay. Yes, question.
But the RPC will happen over...
The RPC will happen over socket, but the socket code you don't worry about. Right. You don't write that code. It is taken care for you. Okay, same is true in Java. Okay, I'll show you some code on RMI later on in the lecture. So if you use Java RMI, you can call an object, okay, a method on an object, and that object resides on some other machine. Okay, it's a Java class, it's a Java object. Object is on some other machine, you call whatever, object one dot some method on that object. The underlying JVM takes care of figuring out where this method object resides, how to execute that method and how to get the results back to you. Okay, so you will write a Java code as if you are writing a centralized app, Java app, and then all of this. So you'll see some examples later on. So that is an example of computation migration. Okay, explicit example of computation migration, because you essentially invoked code that was running on some other machine. Yeah, so that's basically why RPCs are slotted under computation migration. Okay, so job migration, I gave you this example of cloud computing. So there are many other examples of job migration. Okay, but I won't go into other examples except to mention some scenarios where they are used. Okay, the computational speed up was the one I was talking about, where machine gets overloaded, you move that web server running the block to another bigger server, and then you get more speed up for your machine. Okay, so there are other reasons to do this, things like load balancing. Okay, so if you have many machines and load on some machines are higher and some other machines are lower, you can take an entire job, okay, code and the data, and just move it to a less loaded machine. Okay, so then machines get more evenly loaded and all the jobs execute faster. Okay, that's another reason why job migration is used widely. Okay, so it's basically to load balance the machines in your system. Okay, computational speed up is another one. Hardware preference is a third one. If you start a job and you say this job needs this library, okay, maybe you need a certain software package or a library. If it's not present on this machine or your OS can actually take that entire job, send it off to some other server that actually has that package or that library, execute it and get the results back to you. Okay, so that's another place where you can specify hardware or software preferences. Okay, so client server, I already mentioned that briefly. Okay, so a popular way of writing distributed application is called the client server mod. Okay, there are two. There's a client server, and then the other one is called peer to peer. Okay, these are two ways of writing distributed application. In the client server model, okay, the machines that are participating in your application are partitioned into two different types. There's a server, some machines are called servers, some machines are called clients. Servers typically run on more powerful machines, okay, more powerful physical hardware, and clients run on less capable ones. Okay. Servers always provide some useful services that clients access. So that's typically the way client server computing works. Practically most applications you see today, not all but many, use the client server model. Web is an example of client server computing. Clients are browsers, servers are web servers. Okay. Any other application you can think of, most of them would use client server model. Okay, so that's what. The other way to build your application is what's called a peer-to-peer model. The peer-to-peer model, no one node is more distinguished than the others. In a client-server model, some nodes are more distinguished. They are called servers. They are more powerful. They do provide useful things that clients want to access. In the peer-to-peer, all of them are treated as equal. Anybody can be a client or anyone can be a server in a peer-to-peer model. Okay? This is why your music sharing websites applications are called P2P apps. Okay? The reason is, you can download a file from some other machine, in which case you are the client and that other peer acts as the server, or you can upload, somebody can download from you, in which case you become the server node for that file and somebody else who is downloading from you becomes the client. So in the P2P model, the role between a client and a server is blurred. You can be a client or you can be a server at any point in time, and you can keep switching or be both at the same time. Okay, so those are two ways of designing application. Okay, traditionally most applications are used the client server model, it makes more sense, but today you see a variety of P2P applications. Earlier on this class I said Skype is an example of P2P application. Okay. Okay, so in some instant messaging and chat applications are examples of P2P application. Okay. This FaceTime thing that Apple has put out in the iPhones and so on, example of a P2P application. Okay, because you can directly communicate without going through a server. Okay, so many applications use P2P models, but still client-server is still by far the dominant way of writing your distributed app. And within the client-server model, the communication between the clients and the servers in many cases use RPCs. Okay, in some cases, they don't. They use custom protocols like HTTP and SMTP and whatnot. But RPCs are a very common way of writing your distributed application. Okay, so we'll talk now about RPCs in a little more detail. And I'll show you a sample piece of code where you can see the same concepts instantiated in Java. Using Java RMA, but let me see if there are any questions on the client server and P2P. Any questions before we move on to the RPC concepts? Okay. So what are remote procedure calls? Remote procedure calls are a mechanism by which a process that is running on machine A can invoke and execute a function whose code resides on a remote machine. That's why it's called a remote procedure, as opposed to making a local procedure call. Typically, when you call a method or a function, the code, the object, everything resides on that machine. You're just invoking code, typically even within the same address space. If you're now invoking code or invoking methods, that code for that method resides in a different process, we're essentially doing remote procedures or remote method invocation. Okay? So the way this typically works, this is an example of client-server computing. So what happens is the code that, so in this particular case, you can assume that that's the server, that's the client. Okay? So server has a set of methods that it exports. Okay, by exporting, you basically declare to the system that any machine on the network can invoke these methods. Okay, and that's why you are a server. You are providing a service, and the service is you allow anyone to invoke these methods. Okay, so in this case, this server has to export method foo. Okay, when the process starts up, you should say foo is a remote procedure that can be invoked remotely by any other machines on the network. Okay, and when the client starts up, it basically when it will know that this when this method is called, it's not a local procedure but a remote procedure. It will do all the underground, not underground, but internal things that need to be done to figure out where the server is running, how to contact the server, go and basically send a message to the server, invoke that procedure, get it executed, get back the results. Okay, and the program, from a programmer standpoint, you don't have to worry about all of those messy details. Okay, so it makes writing distributed applications that much easier. Okay, yes, question.
But shouldn't you worry about it a little bit? Because if you go and you call foo and it returns like a huge amount of data, wouldn't that all be sent over the network?
Yes, so shouldn't. So if you call foo and it returns you an array of 10,000 entries, that data will come over the network. But whoever designed that remote procedure should have thought about how to write that application. Is that really the intent of sending? Because when you write the remote procedure, you know what the procedure does and what it returns. So if you want us to provide a service where you want to return a large amount of data, then that's the service you write. If you don't want to do that because network is scarce, bandwidth is scarce, then you write your server in some different way. You don't write a procedure that returns data. Instead, you may do some local processing and return results over that data. Okay. So let's go into some details and let me see if there's a figure here that actually there's no figure. Okay. So what happens in remote procedure calls is you will. So this is in C. There's something similar happens in Java. So this is a piece of code that programmer writes. That's a piece of code that a programmer writes. Okay? Doesn't even have to be the same programmer, okay? Because you can have a service and export this method, and somebody else might write a client that invokes that procedure. But for now, let's assume the same programmer has written this. So what you will then, you will also provide a specification, that file that says foo is a remote procedure. Okay, otherwise, there's no way for the compiler to know which procedures are local and which procedures are not remote. Okay. And then you run this through a special compiler, okay, called a RMI compiler, not RMI, RPC compiler. In Unix, this is called RPC Gen. Okay, in the Java world, this is called RMIC. It's called RMI compiler. So what this compiler will do is it will basically take this specification and generate some extra code. Okay, one for the client and one for the server. This code is called a stub. Okay, so it's just a name for a piece of code that is automatically generated by the compiler for you. A special compiler called the RPC. So this is C code, this is also C code, this is C code and that's C code. Okay. What is contained in the stub is all of the code that is required to make the networking happen. Okay, so what the stub code will do is it will link through this application. So when you call foo, it will call a local foo function, not that foo function. There will be a local foo function here that the stub has generated for you. And that local function will have all of the code necessary to say, here set up a socket connection to the server. Okay, take the argument that is passed into foo, construct a network message with that arguments. Okay, send that message over this network. Okay, wait for the result. Okay, so all that is actually generated here. Okay, on the server side, you will write code to listen for incoming requests to invoke this procedure foo. Okay, so you will sit here waiting, listening on a socket. Okay, you will basically, once a request comes, you will process that request and see what are the arguments that have been passed. Okay, you will then call the actual function foo and pass that argument to that function, execute that function, get the results. Okay, the results come back into the stub, and then you will construct another message which contains the results, send it back to the client stub. Okay, then the client stub will get that message and it will return back here, and at that point you get the results of that function. Okay, so all of these details of how to contact the server, how to package the parameters passed to the function, all of that is done automatically in an RPC compiler. So it makes your job of writing applications that much simpler. Okay, so here are the details of how the client stub and the server stub work. So in each invocation of an RPC, you will build a message, okay, you will pack the arguments, send it, wait for a response. Okay, in this case, your server stub is going to be sitting in a loop. Okay, this is a multi-threaded application. It will wait for each request. Whenever a request comes, it will unpack the request, call the procedure, build a reply, send it back. And each thread is going to do that for you. Okay. So, lot of things that happen underneath. Okay, so you have the program, from a programmer standpoint, you don't write all of that code. That's nice. So this code can be several hundred or thousands of lines of code that's automatically generated based on your RPC specification file. Okay, so that's basically that file. So this is something that was designed back in the 80s. Okay, now and it has basically continued to live in different ways even today. Okay, so it basically exists in the Java world as RMIs. It exists in the web service, web world as SOAP. If you heard of this protocol called SOAP, Simple Object Adapter Protocol. So that's basically how to do RPCs in the world of HTTP or web. So this is how web services are built. Okay, so web services can invoke one another using a form of RPC. Also, and there are other types of RPCs called XML RPCs and so on. If you write web applications, someday you might encounter RPCs. Okay, if you don't write, even if you don't write C applications, because they exist in different flavors in different scenarios. Yeah. Yes, question.
So how do you avoid busy wait here? Does the network issue an interrupt, or how does that?
Here in the client's thread?
Yeah, both on client and server.
Right. So what you will do, so that I didn't actually have the whole stub code, but you will not do busy wait. What you will essentially do is you will have a socket. Right. So you will basically, you can send a message on the socket. That's the message that you send to the server saying execute foo with these arguments and send back the result. And then you will basically this is how you will wait for the reply. You will try to read from the socket. This read call is essentially a blocking call. Okay, it will basically make the process wait. Okay, you don't have to send interrupt, you just make a blocking call and you will just wait until the results come back. Okay, it may take an arbitrary amount of time for the results to come back, but you will be blocked. It's almost like waiting for I.O. You are waiting for network I.O. You are not waiting for disk I.O., you are waiting for network I.O., waiting for some packet to arrive. So that is basically what you do. You will not busy wait. You will always use blocking calls to wait for something to happen.
So the way that would come in then is the network data would come in, it would issue an interrupt, the OS would say, oh, this data needs to go to this socket is held by this process, go there and wake up this process.
Yes, so in the OS exactly all of those things happen. So what will happen in the at the OS end is a packet will arrive on your network card. Maybe it's a Wi-Fi card, maybe it's an Ethernet card. It arrives. The network card, which is a piece of hardware, will raise an interrupt to the OS. Okay, the OS kernel will take that interrupt, read the message from the network card and bring it into the OS buffer. It will process that message to see who is this message for. Okay, and then it will say this message is actually meant for this process because it's for a certain socket. It will deliver that message to that process. Process will be woken up and then the contents of the read will be written. Okay, so that's how sockets work. You don't need to know that for this class, but if you want to know the details, that's essentially how things work. Okay? Again, something you probably do in 453, I'm guessing, but I don't know. Okay, so now one question that we did not address here is, it's all fine to say you send a message, you receive a message and so on, but when the client starts up, how does it know where the server is even running? Okay, which machine is it running on, how to contact it, is not hard-coded into the client. Okay? So when you wrote this code, you did not say the server is going to run on this machine. That is not there here. Okay, that has to be figured out on the fly. Okay, so how would you do that? It's not an RPC specific question, it's a general question saying when you're trying to look for a server and you did not hard code the address of the server in your code, how can you actually go and track down where the server is running? Yes, question.
I mean, you could have a way to, you know, input from a list of servers and then when
you
check the server, you can advertise the service.
Okay, so you can do advertisements. That is one way that is used. So there are two actually. One is what is called a directory service, the other one is what's called an advertisement, where you just keep saying I am such a server. Okay. The directory service, you basically have a directory, so when the server starts up, it registers itself with the directory server. Okay, saying I am a server that basically provides, I have exported function foo. If some client wants to access foo, tell him where the name of the machine or the address of the machine where this process is running. This is something you will register with a machine, which could be a third machine in the system or it could be the same as the server. So this is the directory server. Okay. When the client starts up, it first has to contact the directory server and say where is the server with service foo or method foo running. Then the server will tell you the IP address and the socket. Okay, then you bind to that machine. Okay, and then you are done. Okay, so you basically use one level of indirection. Since you don't know where the server is running, you will always basically look for a directory service and then figure this out. Okay. Now, if you think about this carefully, you could be valid in asking how does this client know where the directory service is running. That is also not hard-coded here, right? You could run it on any arbitrary machine. How will you figure that out?
Another DNS server,
you still need to know something. Okay, so there are two ways to do this. One was what was mentioned, which is advertisement. The directory service is either going to broadcast it, saying packets, occasionally saying, I am a directory service on this network. Okay, so you just wait and listen. Wait for an advertisement to come saying here it is. Or you are assigned a broadcast query saying, is there a directory service on this network? And then if somebody responds to you, contact that directory service. Now this often happens, although you probably don't realize this happens when you do DHCP on your machines. Okay, so I presume you heard of DHCP. Anyone not know what DHCP is? Okay. Distribute. So what DHCP is, so it's basically a way for you to get a network address for your machine. Okay, let's say you walk into a coffee shop. Okay, you open up your laptop. Okay, laptop finds a wireless network. Okay, you connect to that network. And then suddenly you are off, you can browse or whatever, you're connected to the network. But there's something happening in between. When you're connected to the network is actually assigning an IP address to your machine. Okay, because the IP address that you have in a coffee shop is, may not be the same IP address you get when you connect to the wireless network here, or you connect to the wireless network in your home. Okay, so every time when you connect to a new network, you have to first get an IP address. Okay? The process of getting IP address is essentially a distributed application. You ask somebody to tell you what address to use. You can't just arbitrarily pick whatever address you like. Yeah, because each network might have some addresses in use, some addresses available. How do you do that? Okay, you ask a directory server saying, give me an address. I need one. The directory server is this is not in use, this is for you. So, and you get it for a certain period of time. Right? Now the same problem arises when you start up, when you walk into a coffee shop, your machine is not configured at all to connect to that network, let alone know where this directory server is running in the coffee shop network. Okay, that is all has to be automatically discovered. Okay, so there's a discovery process that happens. In this case, the discovery process happens by sending a broadcast message saying, is there a DHCP server? Just blast that to every node that is on this wireless network. Okay, and presumably only one node will answer back saying, I'm a DHCP server. Okay, then you know what the machine is and then you contact it. That is called discovery. Okay, so there are applications that do auto-discovery. No, you don't have to tell, so this the task of getting an IP address, you didn't have to do anything. Your machine is configured to figure out where the DHCP server is running, contact it, get an address, configure the address, so you don't do all this. Okay, about 15 years ago, this was not the case. You arrive into a new network, somebody, some sysadmin will tell you, here, use this address. And you start up your machine and then you configure some configuration files, you start some, restart some services and then you are done. Okay, so a lot of manual configuration has been eliminated because of all of this. But the side point, what the reason I was mentioning all this is, directory services provide lots of useful things. Okay, but you need to first know how to contact the directory service. There are many types of directory services available. There's one called LDAP, which is very popular. Okay, in the Windows world, if you know what, if you heard of this term Active Directory, AD servers. So those are directory servers in the Windows world. In the Unix world, on the Mac world, you have something called LDAP or Open LDAP. Okay, that's a lightweight directory access protocol that provides directory services. So when you look up, so they do a lot more than assign IP addresses or things like that. Even the phone book that you see on the UMass people page, okay, that's a directory service. Okay, that's running on the same kind of service called LDAP. You just do a lookup and it will tell you what somebody's phone number is and so on. Okay? Lots of these things need to run for many distributed applications. Okay, directory services are used widely for a variety of different distributed application. When you enter your username and password, either on an OIT page or some departmental page on Spire, the web server actually first contacts the directory server saying, is this the right username password? Okay, things like this are all done using directory services. Okay, but back to our discussion on RPC. So RPCs allow us a way to write distributed application without dealing with all of the messy details of the networking that is involved. Yeah, so your programming abstraction is at a much higher level. You're just writing methods, you just decide that this method lives on this machine, this other method lives on this machine. Here's a client, client can invoke these methods, execute code, get back results, etc. Yeah, so that's basically what is RPC. So we'll now look at an example using in the Java world. Okay, the same concept of RPC is implemented as remote method invocation in the Java world. Okay, so there are some tools here. There's one called the RMI registry. Okay, that is your directory service in the Java world. That is what the server registers itself. When a client code or process wants to invoke a method, it first contacts RMI registry saying, is there an object of this class and this type available, where is it, which machine does it run on. Okay, that's basically what you're going to use. Okay, the RMIC is your RMI compiler. Okay, that's the thing that is going to generate the stubs for you, all of the code to do the networking. Okay, so this is best illustrated with an example. Okay, so we are going to look at some code that does hello world. Okay, so you will contact the server. Server will send us a hello world string. Okay, client and the server are running on different machine. So you have to send a request to get the hello world string. Okay, so here is basically how you will write this Java code. So you have a class called hello. It is going to basically extend the Java RMI class. Okay, this is the class you use to implement a remote object. Okay, any object that basically extend that, it has the capability for those methods to be called remotely. Okay, so then all you basically have here is a say hello function that is going to return a string. Okay, so that's basically the server code. Okay, no, not the server code, that's the specification of what the server does. Okay, so this is essentially the implementation of the server code. Okay, so you have an implementation of the hello, and this is basically the function that you can call, say hello, it returns the string hello world. Okay, so here you say that's the implementation of the class, this is the implementation of the method. Okay, so method is basically one line, it's just returning a string. Okay, this is all the code you are going to write for your server. Okay, notice here that you haven't done anything as far as networking goes. You haven't specified any IP addresses and so on. Yes, question.
What about security? Is this stuff very secure, like if you're sending it over like the internet?
Okay, so question about security. Is this secure if you send it over the internet? So this code is not showing you any security features. Okay, this communication is happening unencrypted. There's no security. There's no authentication. I haven't said that only these machines can talk to me, or you have to specify some username, password before I even allow you to access this service. All that has to be layered on top. Okay, so this is just saying this bare bones communication at this point. Okay, but that doesn't mean you ignore security or issues of authentication, because this will allow any client that can track the server down to call this function and get this string. Okay, so but from a Java perspective, you are writing now a distributed application without doing too much networking. This is all sort of very simple Java stuff that you have written. Okay, other than to say I use the Java RMI package, you haven't done much else. Okay. Here is your client code. Okay, you start with a main function. Okay. This is what you will do to create an object that you will communicate with. Okay, so this is basically where you will call your registry, saying can you find out where this object resides on my network. Okay, so that's basically the object, and you say where is this server running. Okay, so where is this object on the network. So this will basically, this call, although it's just one line, internally will go and actually contact this this RMI registry and figure out which machine the server is running on. Okay, you just do bind of the name, and then here is basically the rest of the client. All you are essentially doing is where is that string? Server name, hold on. Okay, so all you're doing is essentially that code there. Saying object that say hello. Okay, it looks like you're invoking the say hello method on a local object, but that is actually a remote method because object resides on some other machine. So internally, just doing that will trigger network message. It will go to the server. Server will execute that method, return a string. String comes back as a message, and you get it. Okay, so it doesn't show you all of that stuff that is happening internally. So it just looks like you're calling a local method. Okay. So you can write a distributed Java application as if you're writing a local single process or a multi-threaded single machine application. Yes, question.
Go back to where the object was instantiated, because I didn't see that.
This
one? No, it was back to the special.
No.
One more. No, that was the... Where is object instantiated?
Oh, where is object?
Let's see what that looks like, that code.
Oh, Oh, I see. This is the server. So you have created a server object and you have registered yourself with the registry. So this is where you instantiate. This is the main for the server code. So that's the implied. This is the class for the object. This is where you created a new object, and this is where you bound it to the.
What about on the local
machine? The client, yes. So this is that code here. Okay, so you will basically do name lookup. So there you register. So this is name dot bind saying I register with the directory server, and this is going I look up at the directory server where this object is, where the Hello World server is running. Okay, so it is basically you just write that one line and it does the rest. So then it basically gives you basically a local version of the object, which is a remote object, but it stores the fact that it's a remote object. Okay. Now the one thing that I did not mention is passing by reference or passing pointers. Okay, this is something that gets complicated when you have RPCs or RMIs. Okay, so if you think of, do people know what pointers are? Okay, so most of you do. Good. So Java doesn't have pointers. So if you basically in a local, in a single threaded program, you can pass pointers as argument to C functions. Okay? In a remote procedure, passing pointers makes no sense. Okay, if you pass a pointer and you try to dereference it on that machine, that means it's meaningless because the pointer is a memory address. So if you basically point, so if you have int star I, it's a pointer to an integer variable, and you pass I. Okay, if you try to dereference I here, I is actually a memory address in this address space. That address is memory address is meaningless on that machine. Okay, because you dereferencing it takes you to do that address on this machine, not on the original machine. So it doesn't mean anything. Okay, so most RPC systems will prohibit you from having pointers as arguments to remote methods. They will not allow it. It will basically throw a compiler error saying you are trying to pass a pointer to a remote procedure. That's not allowed because it doesn't make any sense here to do. So that is one restriction that you have to keep in mind. When you write distributed application, you can't pass pointers. Now, you could say that the same is true when you pass by reference in Java. In Java, you can pass objects by reference. Okay, so, when you pass an object, entire object to a class, you are passing by reference, you don't make a copy and send it. You don't do pass by value. Okay. However, because it's the same problem, because when you pass by reference, you're essentially passing a pointer. Java RMI relaxes this for you. Java RMI allows you to pass by reference even to remote methods. Okay? And it does all the internal bookkeeping for you. You can dereference that object on a different machine and it keeps track where that object is stored and it figures all of that out for you. Okay? So it relaxes a fundamental limitation of traditional RPC system. You can do pass by reference even to remote methods, but you can't pass pointers in traditional RPC system. Yes, question.
So how does that work? Is it serializing the object and then sending it over the network, or is
Right. So you are asking of details of how this works. So there are many ways to implement this, which again we deal with in a graduate course. But since you asked, I'll just give you the 1 minute summary of it. So the two ways to do this, if you want to pass a reference to the object, is you actually may pass the entire object by value. You take a copy of that object and you send the whole thing over as part of your object invocation, so there's a local copy of the object that you can invoke. That's one way to do it. But now there are two copies. There's a master copy of the object and a local copy. So if you make any change to the state of the object, change any variables, it won't change in the master. Okay, so you could do pass by value, but that has problems. Okay, so what is actually done is you have what are called network pointers. These are pointers that you can dereference over a network. Okay, so instead of sending, a typical pointer is a memory address. Okay, when you have star I is a memory address. In a network pointer, you actually have the IP address of the machine, ID of the process, and an address within that process. Okay, when you dereference a network pointer, it requires that machine to send a message back saying what is this location. Okay, so you basically your system becomes much complex, but you can have things like network pointer. So when you do pass by reference in Java, it essentially does that for you. When you dereference or try to access a method on that object, that will trigger additional messages to the original object. Okay, so there are multiple ways to do it. Could pass the object by value or dereference it over a network. Okay, so it's in summary. So what we discussed today was one very common way of writing distributed applications, which is RPCs and RMIs. And the way you write your distributed application is you figure out first what functionality is on the server, what functionality is on the client. The server functionality is written as a set of functions or objects with methods. And in the client, you either call those functions as if you are calling local functions, or you call methods on the object as if you are calling methods on local object. And all of the extra code that is needed for the server and the client to communicate and execute the method or the function you are invoking, get the results back, all of that is done automatically, written automatically for you, both in Java and in C or C++, whatever language you are using. Or RPC systems will generate all of that stub code for you. So you, the programmer, have to deal with the higher level issue of how to write your application in either client server or peer to peer, whatever method you are using. Don't worry about low level networking details. Okay, so it makes writing distributed applications much, much simpler. You don't have to know or worry about a lot of networking concerns. Okay, so it's a widely used technique to write many applications. Okay, so lots of applications that you will see, network file systems, printing applications, they all use some form of remote procedure calls or RPCs. Not all, but many applications use this popular way of writing distributed apps. Okay. So the only last thing I will mention is you can use RPCs even to write applications that are multiple processes that run on the same machine. So it's just a simple way for applications to communicate. It doesn't have to be the case that clients and servers run on different machines. They could be independent processes running on the same machine that communicate. Okay. So you have RPC applications that do this as well. So keep that in mind. So that is where we will end today. Next week, we have one more class where we'll talk about distributed file system. That's on Tuesday. And on Thursday, we'll have a guest lecture on Linux concepts. Okay, so we would have covered all the concepts in operating systems by Tuesday. So we will do a case study of Linux. We will see how Linux does process management, memory management, storage, file systems, and so on, to the extent we can do it in one class. Okay, it's a lot of material to cover. So let's stop there for today. You have it.